Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for this podcast is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI, and this is my KFI podcast. This show originally aired on Saturday, September 23rd, 2006, on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles. This is show 285.
September 23rd, 2006.
KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 11:06, I'm Deborah Mark, KFI News.
Thank you, Deborah. And a great good morning to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI, on the air at 1-800-520-1KFI. 1-800-520-1534. This is not a computer show. This is a show about technology. And that doesn't mean computers exclusively. I guess we do talk about computers a little bit. Okay, a lot. But really, I've never thought of it as a computer show. It's about the internet. It's about MP3s. It's about PDAs, cell phones, camcorders. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a solid-state camcorder I've been playing with for review. The Sanyo Exacti. That's blowing my mind. This thing is amazing. No tape, just flash. We talk about home theater, big screen TVs. We talk about anything having to do with tech, and that's even biotech and space tech. I mean, this is a broad show covering all areas of technology. And so if you call, anything in that, you know, wide spectrum is open game. You know, they say technology is anything that wasn't around when you were born. So for most of us, that's, many of us. Okay, some of us. That's ATM machines and fax machines and hey, answering machines weren't around when I was born. In fact, color TV wasn't around when I was born. I remember the first color TV. Now I'm standing there like my grandpa. I remember the first radio. If it's new, if it wasn't around when you were coming up, it's technology. I mean, that's something that's been invented and is changing our world. And so that's what we talk about. 1-800-520-1KFI. And yeah, that newfangled radio is pretty cool, too. We'll talk about that. Actually, I get asked a lot nowadays about high def radio. Well, I'm sorry. It's HD radio. It doesn't stand for high def. Yeah, like they named it that, to avoid confusion. Obviously, it's not video, so it's not high def, but it is digital and it is high quality. We can talk about that, too. 1-800-520-1KFI. Can I blow my own horn a little? I'm going to say it once. I'm not going to mention it again, but I'm happy about it. I am the podcaster of the year. And I'm going to get that award in Ontario on Friday at Podcast Expo. Okay, it's not an Emmy. It's not a Grammy. It's not an Oscar. But hey, for a podcaster, it's pretty good. I'll take it. I'm speaking at Podcast Expo. I'm going to give the keynote address on Friday morning. You're invited to join us there. Right after me, actually. Don't come to see me. Come to see... The second key, there's two keynotes. He does like half hour each. The second one's the producer of Battlestar Galactica. Now that's a keynote. Ron Moore is very forward looking. He put Battlestar Galactica up online for download. I think even before the shows came out, like the day before the show came out. Really cool. So he'll be there. And then that evening, I guess I'm winning the award. I think the official title is Podcast Person of the Year or something. It's only the second one that's been given out. Podcasting is only 2 years old, so I'm very honored. I'm really thrilled. Podcasting, for those who don't know, has nothing to do with iPods. It's really just internet audio that you can download. In fact, Apple may precipitate a name change. I was a little shocked by this. You know, I've always said that it's not Microsoft I dislike. It's their monopoly. And I've even said if Apple were to get a monopoly of that size, I bet you they'd be worse. Steve Jobs would be worse than Bill Gates. In your worst nightmare as a monopolist. Well, we may find out, because what do they have a monopoly in? Well, they have a very close to it. What is the technical definition of monopoly? It's not 100% of the market, but it's a pretty like 90% of the market. They're not quite there yet. But their iPods are 80% of the MP3 player market. So they have a big chunk of the MP3 player market. Big chunk. And they're starting to, wield it, frankly. They're starting to throw their weight around. And, this is what happens. When you own a market, you can start calling the shots. And that's the problem. That's why when Microsoft starts calling the shots because it dominates the desktop with Windows, it's bad for everyone. You want competition. You want other people to give you an alternative. You want alternatives. It's just that simple. Alternatives mean there's more innovation because there's incentive to invent and create and improve upon. If you have the market totally, there's no incentive to improve. Your total focus and goal and aim is to consolidate. Not to get better, but to lock people into your platform. There's also no price competition if you dominate. You could charge whatever you want. Microsoft could charge whatever they want for Windows. You'd have to pay it, wouldn't you? In fact, they're quite clever. They build the price into the cost of a new computer, so you're not even really aware of it, frankly. We don't even, you don't even see it. But it's there, believe me. And of course, at some point, you raise it too high, people are going to rebel. But you have much more flexibility than you would if there were competitors. Now, it's interesting because I think Apple, in some respects, they're certainly innovating with the iPod, and they're certainly price sensitive. In fact, they just lowered the prices considerably to make it competitive with the other MP3 players. So I think they don't have a monopoly, and yet they are acting in some ways monopolistically. And here's what I'm talking about. They recently sent a cease and desist order to a company called Podcast Ready. It's podcastready.com. What does Podcast Ready do? They make a product that competes with iTunes. A product that competes only in one limited area with iTunes. It's a product that you can use to download podcasts. It's not trying to sell you music. It's not trying to sell you movies. It's really not competing in any way against iTunes' bread and butter. It's just a podcast program to download these internet radio shows and video shows. And they have a program called My Podder that does that. PodcastReady.com. They got a cease and desist letter from Apple the other day saying, you are infringing on our trademark. Our iPod trademark. Apple is apparently claiming, and this is what's terrifying, that they own the word podcast. Now, they've gone to other websites. For instance, there was the iPod Lounge, which is a great iPod website. And they said, you can't use the word iPod. Okay, I understand that. iPodExtreme.com, my friend Patrick Norton's site. You can't use iPod. I understand that. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think there's any confusion. People know you're covering iPods. You're not selling iPods. They know where iPods come from. But, trademark law is such that if you don't defend your trademark, you could lose it. And Apple doesn't want to become the Kleenex of the world. They want to maintain that iPod trademark. And so their lawyers, I'm sure, no doubt, are saying, well, look, maybe we don't want to, but we got to. But wait a minute. Do they have to do it about the word podcast? Do they have to go out after companies that use the word podcast? Because if they do, there's a big problem. Because it's in the dictionary. They're asserting, apparently, that the word podcast is theirs, their trademark. And as a podcaster, boy, that scares me. What do we do? Do we rename ourselves? Now, that's an issue for podcasters, and I know you don't care about that. But I think the larger issue is monopoly. That's the threat. When a company owns too much of the market, they no matter what, they start looking ugly. IBM did it in the 50s and 60s when they owned the mainframe computer market. Fortunately, their monopoly was cracked. Phone companies did it. Phone companies have such a long-term, AT&T has such a long tradition of not having to care about customers that even though they're no longer a monopoly, they still don't seem to care very much. They're trying. Cell phone companies never had a monopoly, and they still act as if they do. It's an insidious corporate culture. It gets in your head. And even if you don't have anything to back it up, it can change how you operate. It's good to be humble. It's good to have competition. I'm glad this show has competition. In fact, this market, this LA market, has more computer talk shows than any other market in the country. That's a good thing. That makes me try harder, makes me do a better job, makes me pay attention. Competition's a good thing. Nobody likes it, but the alternative, monopoly, is a very bad thing. So sometimes people accuse me of being too pro-Mac. And certainly I think the Mac platform is the ideal platform for the home. I absolutely do think that. But really what I am is pro-competition. I'm pro-Linux as well. I'm pro-anything that will compete with Microsoft Windows monopoly. And now, I got to say, I'm upset about Apple. I think Apple's monopoly in the iPod and the iTunes world is bad for us all. We've got to find some alternatives. Go to Podcast Ready. Download their program. Start using that. Look at other MP3 players. Maybe it's time somebody cracked this monopoly. What you don't want is a company that is so powerful, so big, that they don't have to listen to you. They don't have to worry about how much they charge. They can get away with murder. That's what you don't want. Let's talk about that or anything else on your mind. Technology is the topic. And that means computers, yes, the internet, yes, but MP3 players, cell phones, camcorders, anything you want to talk about. I'll give you a review of that exactly down the road. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 11:17.
Tip your waiters, you tip the valet. So why not tip your favorite radio station? Call the KFI News tip line. It's always open at 323-CALL-KFI.
KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Let me give you my phone number. 1-800-520-1KFI, 1-800-520-1534. Jerry Altadena, welcome to KFI.
Good morning, Leo.
Morning, Jerry.
I have a need for a new monitor, and what I do is a lot of internet. I do word processing, but more importantly, I do photo editing in Photoshop, and I'm going to be soon getting into video editing.
Mm-hmm.
So I really need accurate color representation. And what I've been reading is that the LCD monitors don't do that and that I should stick with CRT.
That's right.
So if that's true, and I'd like your opinion on that, what 21-inch CRT monitor would you recommend?
The problem with LCDs is their blacks aren't black and their whites aren't white. And you have a fluorescent backdrop, which is inaccurate. Now, some of the newer LED-based LCDs, might be more accurate. They'll certainly have different characteristics. I have to say, for all that, you go and you look at where graphic professionals are working, and they're still using LCDs because of this convenience, frankly. The size of a 20-inch or 23 or, heaven forfend, a 30-inch CRT, you would have to have a desk twice as big as the one you got.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them just put up with it. No, you know, once, you know, first of all, no monitor is accurate. No monitor is going to give you the same result as your printout is going to get. So, you know, these guys live with that and they know and they make adjustments in their head and they make adjustments on in their software to accommodate the fact that they're not getting accurate reproduction. Part of the problem is just that a monitor is a different form of color generation. You know, it's not reflective, it's transmissive. So it's just creating color in a completely different way. It's creating colors by adding them. So you're never going to get a perfect match. How serious, I mean, what when you say you're serious about color, I mean, how serious are you? Are you professional?
Well, I'm just working on scanning my thousands and thousands of negatives into the computer, and a lot of them need color correction. And so I'm just learning in Photoshop how to do, fine color corrections to make it look right.
Yeah, well, what I would always do is of course, keep the original. And any changes you make are changes that are specific to that time. It's a tough one. You can get a CRT. How big a monitor do you want?
21.
Yeah, I mean, you know how you probably looked at these, but I remember the dark old days of 20-inch and 21-inch monitors, and they're 3 feet deep.
Yeah, that's really not a problem in terms of space. I'm more concerned about weight, but
they're 50 pounds, 100 pounds. They're huge.
Yeah, a lot of them are in the vicinity of 60 pounds.
But
that's okay. I can handle that. It's just a matter of getting it in the house more than where I'm going to put it.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I don't know. I'll be honest. I don't. Since you care that much, I'm not going to make a judgment on what colors, what monitor, what CRT gives you get the best, most accurate reproduction. I just don't know. We'll have to ask professionals to call in or put it in the show notes or whatever. Because you know, if you're going to be that picky, you know, I there are a lot of good CRTs and I've used many, but I don't know what the best color reproduction is.
Part of the problem, Leo, is that the stores aren't carrying CRTs anymore, so I can't just go and look at a bank of CRT monitors. I have to try and judge online reviews and the like, and it's very difficult to pick from that.
Well, I would go to a place like PCMag.com, and what they do in their labs is they have, specifically for this purpose, they have color accuracy measurements that they use. And they'll give you, the best. They'll tell you who the best is in terms of color accuracy. I think you can kind of go crazy over this. I'm a fan of the ViewSonics, NEC, Sony, of course, but I'm not sure who is the most accurate in color. You'd have to. I haven't looked at CRTs in ages. And most of the graphics pros I know use LCDs. They just live with it. Because of all the disadvantages of a CRT. And you know, by the way, that there's other issues, too. There's warm-up time. You may have to... That CRT, you should probably leave on for half an hour before you even look at the color. There's what background color, what lighting you have in the room. And after a year or so, you're going to have to buy a new one. Because, I mean, if you care that much about color, it doesn't maintain its accuracy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 11:29. Deborah Marks in the KFI News Center.
Hate that behind the eight ball Monday morning feeling? Stay in the loop all weekend long. More stimulating weekends.
KFI AM 640.
11:38. KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI. Oh, my goodness. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number. 1-800-520-1534. Tim is in Upland. Hello, Tim. Welcome to KFI.
Hey, Leo, I've got a question about email hosting.
Yes, yes.
I finally got my website, and now I want to, you know, be able to get email at my email.com, right?
Right.
And so what's the best way to host your email?
Well, you already have a domain name through somebody.
Right.
So sometimes they will offer it. Maybe it's not the best way, but sometimes they will offer it. It might be the most cost effective. If, you know, if it's GoDaddy or whoever, they all offer email.
Right.
I'm going to make a recommendation about a company I just learned about that's here in the Southland and I think is very good, called Island Email, ISLANDEMAIL.com. And they will do the same thing. I think it's $5 a month. So what happens is you change your MX record to point to them. Now, that's something you can easily do. If you're able to, you know, get into your DNS records, you can change that. Otherwise, you can ask your company that owns the domain name to do that.
Right.
It's a fairly simple thing to do. And what will happen is all the mail that comes to, you know, Tim at, you know, upland.com or whatever it is, will go through Island Email. Now, here's what's cool about this. First of all, they use MailRoute Spam Filtering, which is the company I use. And that's how I found out about them. They're a partner with MailRoute. Which does, by the way, not only spam, but virus blocking. They offer POP3 or IMAP, which is really handy. I actually recommend IMAP for advanced email users. It's a real good, a better way to do it than POP3. You know, the way POP3 works, you log into your ISP, you download all the mail to your client, and it deletes it from the server. And the problem if you have more than one computer is it's never in sync.
Right.
IMAP is more like having a central server that you just kind of get a window into. And it works with all clients. Outlook works fine with IMAP. So that's one choice. Something like Island Email. There are many other companies. I actually don't use Island Email. I use Fastmail.
Okay.
Same thing. Now, Fastmail doesn't offer mail route, but I have a mail route account. So my email is kind of funny. I mean, what happens is it goes. So you send a message to Leo at leoville.com. First, it goes to the company that hosts my servers. The MX record there has changed. They send it to MailRoute. Then MailRoute sends it not back to Leoville, but to Fastmail, to a private address at Fastmail, and Fastmail becomes where my mail lives. So it's kind of being routed all over the place. But you can do that with mail, and it works fine. I think it's a good idea. One of the things I like about Fastmail, they're an IMAP provider. They're very affordable. I think it's $30 a year for lots of services. They have very good email filtering. They use a program called Civ. Again, these are power tools for power mail users. But what you're asking me sounds like you're a power user.
I'd like to think so.
Well, more and more we have to be power users. You know, if you use email, because of spam, because of the fact that everybody's starting to send everything via email, you know, you have to kind of become good at managing email. I think that may be job one going forward for most of us geeks, is how do we handle our email? And I think Island Email is a place to look. Fastmail. Who's your domain registered with?
GoDaddy.
Yeah, GoDaddy has it too. I've never used GoDaddy's services. I'm a mixed feelings about GoDaddy. I register all my domains through them because they're cheap. But I also noticed they're really trying to squeeze every penny out of you, aren't they?
You get that done, and then we have all of this.
How would you like to buy this?
Yeah.
Which I know these guys, and I'm sure they're fine. It bugs me. So, but they offer, I don't know, it's not like $5 or $6 a month. They offer a similar email service. All that's happening is the mail is going to their servers and they're storing it there for you to dial in and download it. That's really what anybody will provide for you.
Right.
I love this idea because now you don't have to worry about changing internet service providers. You don't have to worry if you move or whatever.
Right.
Your address is always tim@upland.com or whatever, because and then that's really a good idea. I recommend everybody do this. In fact, I'm thinking when you have a kid, the first thing you should do is go out and register their name as a domain so that you own it, right?
Right, right.
And in fact, I bet you in the next few years, parents will actually do a search before they name their kid. Make sure they can get that domain name. Okay, maybe I'm a little geeky.
Name my son because the domain was gone.
Yeah, right. Oh, I can't use that name. We've got to find another one. You know, we do that now. If you're starting a company, if you're starting a business, the first thing you do, you do a trademark search or a copyright search, but you also check to make sure you can get a domain name. You'd be foolish to take a business name that you couldn't get the domain name for.
Right.
So it's kind of, I think people are going to start thinking about that when they name their kids. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. Call me nuts. Does that answer your question? Is there any more you'd like to?
Absolutely, no, that's it.
Yeah, I haven't tried Island Email, but Tom, the guy who runs MailRoute, is a good friend, and I really trust him, and he says they're great. In fact, I think MailRoute uses them. Unfortunately, and this always bugs me, you have to talk to a human to sign up, which always bugs. I want to do everything online.
Right.
But they have to talk to a salesperson, but they do seem to offer, I think, very good service. They do everything I would say you need. So try that.
Awesome.
In fact, if you do try it, thank you, Tim. If you do try it, send me an email. If you get through my filters, but I'd like a review because, in fact, I probably should set up an account with them just to try them. A couple of things I like about them: unlimited mail storage, unlimited file attachment size. I don't know anybody else who does this. And I think that's very cool. In fact, my Fastmail account, I have a certain amount of storage, and I constantly have to buy more storage because I like to keep every message. I don't like to delete messages. And this is another reason why email management is increasingly and is, job one for people who live online. That email database is gold, don't you think? I mean, somebody sent me something, or I try to remember. A good searchable email database is very valuable. That's why people like Google Mail. Google Mail has virtually unlimited storage. I think it's over 2 gigabytes now, and it keeps going up. But Island says no limit. And believe me, I have several gigabytes worth of email, and I'd have more except for at one point I had a disaster and lost everything. Grant Lancaster, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Grant.
Hi. Thanks, Leo.
Sure.
I'm going to be getting a really high-end gaming system here really soon.
Ooh, baby.
And, you know, all the new chips like the Dual Core 2 are 64-bit, and I just haven't seen any since. And going and buying a system until a 64-bit operating system comes out.
Well, yes and no. First of all, your games aren't 64-bit.
The ones I'm actually already signed up for beta testing are.
You really want to be cutting edge.
I want to go the full 4 gigs, you know, which don't.
That's the big. There's only a few advantages to going to these 64-bit operating systems. Number one is lots of memory. You could go with a 64-bit. Go with 64-bit Windows.
So I should. You think I should wait till the Vista comes out?
Well, I'll tell you why you'd want to wait. I'll tell you why you'd want to wait now. It's not a question of Vista. It's just that, you know, as soon as you go to and, you know, listen to the show, you'll hear people call and say, "Well, I went to Windows 64, but none of my drivers work. None of my hardware is working. My antivirus isn't working." You know, it's bleeding edge. If you're the kind of geek who likes to live on the edge, then it's certainly, you know, the way to go. But I'm not sure you gain much advantage. Games could, in theory, because here's the advantage of 64-bit. Let me just kind of explain what this all is about, really. Operating systems, when they first came out, were 8-bit. What that means is kind of the natural size of data that your microprocessor can work with. So the early processors, 8-bit chunks of data. That's 1 byte. That's actually not bad because we represent, or until recently represented, characters as 1 byte. It's just a natural number. Then we went to 16-bit. That started with Windows 95, I guess, was 16-bit. Then we went to 32-bit. And all the versions of Windows right out, the mainstream version of Windows right now are 32-bit. Processors are starting to be 64-bit. That means their registers are 64 bits wide, 8 bytes wide. That's big chunks of data. Does it help you with your word processor? No, your word processor is now working with 16-bit letters, no more. Where it helps you is when you're... Two things. One is you can address more memory because your memory space is also 64-bit. That's terabytes of memory. Windows right now won't go bigger than 4 gigs. So if you want more than 4 gigs, you need a 64-bit processor. And you need a 64-bit operating system. I don't know if you need more than 4 gigs. 4 gigs is a lot of RAM.
That's what I was going to put on.
Yeah.
4 gigs.
Well, Windows will do 4 gigs right now. And then the next thing is that you can also operate on data in big chunks. Now, in a game, that's important because you are operating on data in big chunks. Textures, bitmaps. Anytime you're doing 3D rendering or things like that, or maybe converting video and audio, those things operate on big chunks of data. But our processors are designed nowadays to use something called SSE or SIMD, single instruction, multiple data. And what it does is it means you can operate. Let's say your instruction is, okay, I want to rotate everything by 8 bits. Well, you can do that one instruction across a whole bunch of data. So the size of the register is less important now than it used to be. You certainly want an SSE2 processor, that kind of thing. I'll have to talk to some game developers about this 64-bit and whether they really, truly feel they'll get some benefit out of it. It's one of those buzzwords in the industry where people, you know, more is better, right? And I'm not convinced. Will we have 128-bit processors? I suppose at some point, but who cares? I don't think we need them. I don't know if we need 64-bit. Having said that, I just spent a lot of money, way too much money, on a 64-bit computer. So, and 4 gigs of RAM. So there you go. Maybe I should listen to what I say, not what I do. Yes, if you want to run 64 bits, you can do it now. There are compatibility issues. Will it be better when Vista comes out? Probably, but just because it's a few months later. As time goes by, drivers will be updated. Hardware will be updated. You won't be quite on the bleeding edge. That's the advantage you'll get. Well, Vista isn't inherently better at 64 bits. It's just that its time has gone by. 11:50, 10 away from noon. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Hot, fresh, John and Ken. Now open weekends. John and Ken, Saturdays starting at 3.
KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1534. Ken Sherman Oaks, welcome to KFI.
How are you?
I am very well. How are you?
Good. I wanted to tell you that I took your recommendation and I subscribed to Nod 32 ESET, and so far in the last 5-6 days, it's great. And I wanted to let you know
Thank
how
you.
Much I appreciate your recommendation.
The only thing sometimes people complain about is that the user interface is very detailed and difficult sometimes to grasp. Have you had trouble with that?
Not yet. And the one of the well, I was.
I worry sometimes because you know I've been doing this stuff for so long I don't even think about that. And frankly, once you said it, I don't even see it anymore. But some people have told me, oh, it's kind of hard to understand.
No, I don't. The only thing that I'm told that I should scan once a week.
Yep.
And I was told that now everyone's confusing me. There, half the people tell me that SpyBot and Adaware conflict with each other, and some people say run them both.
I say run them both. What you may see with some spyware, and this is true of antiviruses too, is they see the other program as spyware. And the reason is the other program contains definitions for spyware, which look to the, you know, SpyBot has, just like any antivirus, spyware programs use what they call a definite virus definitions or spyware definitions, which are just really strings of text that appear in the bad programs, right? And sometimes, if you know, by it's an error, usually, one antivirus will see that string in another and say, whoa, there's a virus. Or one anti-spyware will see that string in another and say, whoa, there's a spyware program. That's a false positive. So if you ever see an antivirus complain about an anti-spyware program or an anti-spyware program complain about another one, that's not an incompatibility. That's merely, a false positive. Now, where you can get conflicts is with stuff running simultaneously in the background. So, but Adaware doesn't usually, what I would say is only choose one for kind of the all-the-time, real-time protection.
Well, that was my question. Which one?
Now, did you pay for Adaware or are you just using the free Adaware?
The free Adaware.
Yeah, it doesn't even allow.
The free SpyBot also.
Yeah, the free SpyBot has built-in immunization, but the free Adaware, unless they've changed it, doesn't allow you to use that unless you pay for it. So there's not even really a problem. You just turn on the immunization in SpyBot. Most of that, by the way, is passive. It's not actively searching stuff. Nod 32 has very sophisticated heuristics looking for spyware-like activity, so it's doing a good job of keeping programs from modifying system files, things like that. And you can use Adaware to scan once in a while. You definitely need more than one anti-spyware because no one anti-spyware program catches all the spyware.
But okay, so then having ESET or Nod 32 is not enough. You have to add.
You
one
have
or
to
the
have
other.
Yeah. The more and when it comes to spyware, more is better. But Nod 32 will often catch it. There is one other thing that you should do. And because this is commercial radio, I'm going to say stay tuned because I'll tell you right after the break. I just don't have time. We've got news. But there is one thing I think all Windows users should do that's very important. Leo Laporte, and I'll tell you about that in just a minute. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 11:59. Let's head to the KFI newsroom with Lisa Osborne has the latest.
September 23rd, 2006.
KFI is a talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. It's 12:07. I'm Lisa Osborne, KFI News.
Thank you, Lisa. Good afternoon. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Let me give you the phone number, 1-800-520-1KFI, 1-800-520-1534. I have to tell you, there's a very, very, very important security bulletin I want to give you. For Windows XP users, you've heard me say before, do not use Internet Explorer. Please. This is just one more reason not to. And the thing that's really galling me is this is as important a security bulletin as I've ever given. We've known about it since Wednesday or Thursday. We did, in fact, a special Security Now podcast just to let people know about this. And I've seen literally zero coverage in any of the tech media. I mean, okay, mainstream media, I understand. But CNET, Dig, Slashdot, nothing. And I'm trying to figure out, is this because we're so used to horrible Windows security flaws that it's just not worth reporting anymore? Are we just bombarded with these so often that we just stopped saying anything about it? Maybe. Maybe, but it's just a real problem. At 1 o'clock, Steve Gibson will join us. He's the host, co-host with me of Security Now, and a great security guy at Shields Up and GRC.com. And we'll talk to him about the flaw, how it works, what to do about it. Short term, probably a good idea to use Firefox. And it's free, and it's a good browser, and you can use it easily and quickly. It'll take your bookmarks and everything. Just go to getfirefox.com. Sometimes people get confused about the name. It's F-I-R-E-F-O-X, Firefox, at getfirefox.com. Now, there is a fix. You can continue to use Internet Explorer, but you have to unregister a DLL. Yeah, as soon as I say that, your eyes should roll up into your head. And it could conceivably cause compatibility issues with other programs. I've been told anecdotally that Peachtree accounting doesn't work if you unregister this. So the simple and quick fix is just, you know, don't use Internet Explorer. Oh, by the way, if you use Outlook to preview your email, you're using Internet Explorer. If you use any mail program to preview your email, it uses the Internet Explorer engine to draw those HTML emails, and you're just as vulnerable. You could get it in an email. So let me tell you, we're going to talk about it at one. The general gist of it is there is a flaw in one of Microsoft Windows' library. It doesn't matter how patched your system is. A fully patched system is vulnerable. This library is for displaying an oddball graphic format. It's kind of similar to a hole that occurred a few months ago in the WMF. This is in the VML, vector markup language. It's the vector file format. Most web pages do not use it. And in fact, that's kind of why this is a security problem, because once you know this hole exists, you could just put a malformed graphic on your web page, and you could put anything on anybody's system, a Trojan horse, spyware, adware, a virus, anything on anybody's system. All they have to do is surf to your website or preview your email with this graphic embedded in it, and that's it. They're dead. And if you're using, even if you're using a patched version of Windows, you're vulnerable. So it's a serious hole, and I just really hope that people pay attention to this and just stop using Internet Explorer. In the next hour, Steve Gibson will talk about it. Now, I mentioned before the break that I was going to tell you probably the most important thing you can do to protect yourself in Windows. We've talked about, of course, a few of these, running an antivirus, running anti-spyware, patching regularly. By the way, doing all of those things will not protect you from this vulnerability. It might actually detect a virus that or a spyware program that is put on your system by this vulnerability. But then again, it might not. You should have a firewall. Wouldn't protect you in this case, but it certainly protects you against other things. You should have, and by the way, a router is a good firewall. If you have a broadband router, you're safe. And finally, the most important thing, or one of the most important things, don't use Internet Explorer. And finally, one of the most important things is don't run as administrator. Now, I know this is a real pain in Windows, but you should never run as administrator in any operating system. You should never run as the root or administrator in Linux, in Windows, in Mac. It's just too dangerous. And the reason is any bad guy that is able to get through your defenses inherits the capabilities that you have on your system. So if you're running as a power user on your system, as an administrator, that bad program can do whatever you can do. On the other hand, if you're running as a limited user, that program can only do what you could do. So it can't, for instance, install itself. Limited users can't install software. There are exceptions to this. There are what they call escalation problems that can happen. But in fact, we recently saw an escalation problem on the Mac side with the Mac installer. And the fix there is not to run as administrator. If you run as a normal user on Macintosh, you're not vulnerable. If you run as a normal user on Windows, many, many spyware programs can be completely stymied. They need to be able to install themselves. Now, it does cause headaches. In fact, some software won't run at all, although that's getting less and less of a problem. Software's finally, you know, realizing, hey, it's not Windows 98. You don't have absolute access to the system anymore. You have to behave by the rules, and it's going to be really true in Vista. This is, by the way, probably the most important security change in Vista, is that you will have to kind of run as a limited user most of the time. So simply doing that, you know, you can do it right now. Just create a new user account on your system and make it a limited user account. and use that day to day. When you need to install something, log in as administrator. Or you can even right-click on an application, select Run As from the pop-up menu, and run it as an administrator if you need to. But day-to-day, you should not be running as administrator. I haven't been stressing that as much as I should, mostly because Windows doesn't like it. It's in the past been very difficult to do that. But, you know, it's gotten much easier in the last few months. Programs have finally realized, maybe we ought to be doing it this way. Best advice I could give you. Wayne and Colton, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Wayne.
Yeah, I've seen the explosion like you have of MP3 players 20 years ago. There was no such thing.
Right.
My thing is I don't like MP3s. I like the quality of at least CD quality sound. And I'm wondering if technology is offering anything where you can store large amounts of, you know, say WAV files, things like that, where you don't have to, have to stack CDs and things like that.
Right. Absolutely. MP3 is what we call lossy compression. It takes data out in order to compress it. That's why it can compress 11:1.
Exactly.
If you use a zipping program, that's lossless compression, and you have to use that on a program. You can't take pieces of a program out. And you notice that it doesn't compress as well. In fact, if you try to compress a CD WAV file, an imported WAV file with zip, you'll only get maybe at best, 50% compression at best. Nothing like the 10:1. So,
exactly.
But the theory behind MP3 and all these other, and by the way, almost all the music compression technologies are lossy. AAC, MP3, AUG, and same thing with video. The theory behind it is you take out the stuff people don't hear or see. And it's actually kind of interesting. The guy who invented MP3, he's a German engineer at the Fraunhofer Institute. And I actually interviewed him once. He's a fascinating fella. He realized that there's a way the human ear behaves. When it's listening to one frequency, it masks out certain subsidiary frequencies. And we think it's a way of focusing attention. So he observed this and said, well, if you're listening to this particular frequency, you can't hear these side frequencies. So I'm just going to cut them out. And for the most part, that works. In fact, if you use a high enough bit rate with MP3, most people cannot tell the difference. Now, if you've got golden ears, Wayne, and you really want perfect sound, you may notice it. And AAC, which is an improved version of MP3, does better, but it's still not perfect. Windows Media does better, but it's still not perfect. But there are lossless compression engines designed for audio, for people like you who want to basically make a perfect copy of your CD and compress it as much as you can without losing any of the data. There are two. On Windows, there's one called Ape, but it's Windows only, so I don't usually recommend it. On Mac, there's one called the Apple Lossless Compression, but again, it's iTunes only, so unless you're using iTunes, it's probably not a good idea. The one that is kind of the most universal and open source is called FLAC, F-L-A-C, which stands for the Free Lossless Audio Codec. You can find out more about it by going to Wikipedia and typing in FLAC or Google FLAC. Again, a problem. Most MP3 players can't handle it. It's rare. iPods will handle the Apple lossless format. So if you knew you were going to be listening to iPods and you knew you were going to be using iTunes, I would recommend that because at least you can put it on your Apple. Now, remember, you're not compressing it as much, so you're going to have fewer songs per iPod, but at least it will be better quality. And the real advantage is you can now throw away the CD because you actually have a copy of the CD that's every bit as good as the original. There's no data is lost. So that also has the advantage of if better technologies or more universal technologies come down the road, or you decide, well, I want to save space and I want to make an MP3, you can do that without losing any data. You haven't lost anything. So FLAC, Ape, or Apple lossless, and it really kind of depends on what platform you're on and so forth. I know audiophiles who use Ape, and they'll make big DVDs of data files of Ape CDs. You can get maybe 10 or 15 or 20 CDs on a single DVD. I do that with my Christmas music, for instance. I don't want that lying around all year. So I always lose the CDs or get them scratched or something. So I converted them with a lossless compression, put them on a DVD, and then I kind of reburn the CDs every year, and I have fresh Christmas CDs.
Okay.
So those are the three. FLAC is, of course, the most universal. But I think if you're going to use iTunes and you want, I don't know of many portable players that will play back any of these formats. The only ones I'm sure of is iPods and Apple lossless.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Just because it's the weekend doesn't mean you got to get stupid. More stimulating weekends.
Blow, Daddy!
Blow, Daddy! Yow! KFI. AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. A KFI. Show notes are online. Shuby's doing a great job keeping track of everything we're talking about. You can get to that by going to KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. KFI AM 640.com for short. KFI AM 640.com. And if you hover your mouse over the shows menu, you'll see my name, Leo Laporte. If you're listening live, of course, you just click my picture, and that'll take you to my page on the KFI site. And then click the official website, and that'll take you to leo.am. Once you're there, after all those shenanigans, just click Saturday show. That's today. 285 it is. Now, I will update those show notes. I'm going to Shuby's doing it now, and I'm going to actually put in a comment box so that people can add some comments, because there have been a couple of questions I haven't been able to answer. And that's kind of one of the best things about having those show notes online, is getting people to add their thoughts. A lot of chat in the chat room about high-quality audio. And I understand there are some MP3 players now that support FLAC, which is great news. But remember, you're not going to get the compression. You know, it's like a 2-to-1 compression instead of 10 or 11 to 1. And so you're going to have 1/5 the number of songs on there. So don't get bummed out when you get 20 songs on your gigabyte player, because that's it. It'll be more than that, but you get the idea. It might not be much more than that. I have to tell you, I don't hear the difference. And I suppose I should bring this up. It's like in the first hour, somebody was asking about colors on monitors. I don't see the difference. And the same thing with the sound. I don't hear the difference. But if you have very high quality hearing, maybe you would. I'm an old guy. I've been a talk show host for years. My ears are shot because of the headphones we wear and everything. I actually remember walking by Dolby Labs in San Francisco a couple of years ago. Guy out front recognized me. He was an engineer there. Said, come here, I want to show you something. Brought me into their beautiful facility where they have a reference room, a reference audio room. It's at what they call an anechoic chamber. Soundproofed in such a way that there's no reflections. It's designed for perfect audio reproduction. And they had in there some really nice Rebel speakers, really good, you know, $20,000 speakers, a perfect sound system. And he said, I just want to play something for you. Now, remember, this is Dolby, who had an investment in AAC. They were really the, well, along with Fraunhofer, the group that made AAC. They had Dolby Sound. They don't have really an investment in MP3. In fact, they have quite the opposite. MP3, they don't make any money on MP3s. But the engineer said, let me just play you some MP3s, and you can compare. Do an A-B comparison with the CD. At 128 kilobits per second, which is kind of the normal compression that, you know, when you buy on iTunes and other stores, that's what you get. I could definitely tell the difference between the CD audio and the MP3. I could pick it every time, 100% of the time. He went to 160 kilobits per second. God, I couldn't tell the difference. 192, couldn't tell the difference. I think if you encode at a high bit rate, 160 is probably enough for most people. Let's say try 192. I think it's pretty close. Now, there are those who say, well, yes, but CDs stink anyway. And that, you know, if you could tell the difference between a vinyl LP and a CD and you prefer vinyl, okay, fine. Okay, I understand, you know, you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din. But if you can't tell the difference, I would suggest trying for yourself with the best audio reproduction equipment you can find. Just do an A-B comparison. Get somebody else to press the buttons. So it's really objective. And I have a feeling you'll be hard-pressed to tell the difference, even at 160 kilobits. It's 1229. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Let's head to the KFI News Center. That's where Lisa Osborne has the latest.
K KFI Weekends, the stimulating talk you want and the Southern California news you need.
KFI AM 640.
KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1KFI. That's my phone number. 1-800-520-1534. Let's go back to the phones. And Alex in Orange. Hello, Alex. Welcome to KFI.
Hi, Leo. My iPod won't wake up.
I hate it when that happens.
Well, I died, and I plugged it into the charger, and nothing happened. And I pressed the middle button, and the app will finally come up. And then it'll disappear, and it's like it's dead.
Okay. So there is a reset command on the iPod.
Okay.
You press the middle button and the menu button, and you hold it, and you hold it, and you hold it, and you hold it, and you hold it until it resets. And then you'll see that shiny little apple. But if it won't go any farther than that, it means probably that the hard drive itself is... Now, there's two possibilities. Is damaged, or is just, you know, got screwed up a little bit and can be reformatted. So what you hope is it's the latter, because that you can fix yourself. You just dock it and run the iPod. Are you on Windows or Mac?
I have Windows.
Okay. It's built in now. In the new iTunes 7, it's built in. But if you don't have iTunes 7, you can download the, what's it called, a firmware update. And what it has the ability to not to basically set the iPod back to its original factory settings, including it'll format the drive if it needs to. So they call that the restore or, you know, the firmware. I think you open the firmware and it says restore. If it can't fix it, then it means you have a hard drive. I mean, that's a hard drive in there, just like any other. And sometimes they die.
Yeah.
And then it means your hard drive is dead. And that's, of course, the worst news, because now you got to, if it's under warranty, you'll get it repaired. But if not, you're kind of out of luck.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
The real question is there stuff on that iPod you don't have copies of?
Yes, but I can always just make CDs.
Oh, good. All right. Yeah, something everybody's got to remember is that when you buy something from the iTunes Music Store, you only get to download it once. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, take good care of this. It's just like a CD. They will not let you re-download it. They could. They know what you've bought. Audible does with its books, but iTunes, for some reason, does not. So make sure you treat those things like gold. It's like, you know, if your iPod is the only copy of a song that you bought in the iTunes Music Store, back it up. Like any hard drive, back it up. Mark Corona, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I'm calling for my Vonage broadband and also using Skype. But first of all, I want to go back to the question or the thing you talked about with the Outlook when you... go to preview, use Internet Explorer.
The preview pane, yeah.
The preview pane. Yeah. I use Firefox, but I use also Outlook to get my emails.
Sure. So does everybody.
So is there an alternative, or I just don't use Outlook to do that anymore?
No, you can use Outlook. Just turn off the preview pane. So it's under the view menu. You can't use the preview pane. Now, this is a little bit of a disadvantage because probably you, like most people, read your email in the preview pane.
Yeah, I just view it and I delete it before I even look at it.
That's right.
Sometimes.
So what I would suggest, I mean, the only safe way to use Outlook, I've said this for a long time and nobody ever does it, but is to turn off that preview pane. Go through your mail and delete anything that you don't, you know, that's suspicious. It's spam or you didn't expect or it's not from somebody you care about or whatever. Just delete it before you look at it. Then you could safely open the preview pane and go through your mail. But the problem is that you can get a spam email. And, you know, you're just going through your mail, pressing the down key, and you see, oh, it's spam, you delete it. It's too late. You just got infected. Because the minute that graphic, this is this new hole that we've been talking about, and Steve Gibson will give us the details at one, but the minute that new that graphic, that infected graphic is displayed, you are infected. And that's what happens in the preview pane. So that's the real danger of, I've been inveighing against HTML mail for a long time. People say, well, but that's, if you don't use HTML mail, you can't put graphics in your mail and you can't use fonts. And that's right. Guess what the danger is here? It's the graphic. So, are there other programs? Thunderbird. That's the same folks who do Mozilla. And Thunderbird will also do a preview pane, but it uses the Mozilla engine to display graphics. Now, by the way, Mozilla is not completely safe either. But it's safer than Internet Explorer for two reasons. One, it's less of a target. I mean, Internet Explorer is what everybody uses. Outlook is what everybody uses. So that's what the hackers go against, right? But the other reason is it doesn't support some dangerous technologies like ActiveX and Active Scripting that are often used to infect. And in this case, Firefox is dumb. It doesn't support the VML file format, that oddball file format, graphic file format. So there's no danger. It did, and if it used the Windows DLL to display it, then it would be just as dangerous as Internet Explorer. But because it doesn't, it looks at it and says, I don't know that graphic format. What is that? And it just doesn't display it. So, yes, Thunderbird would be safer if you're really tied to that preview pane. Otherwise, turn off the preview pane and delete any unknown emails before you use that to read it. Or you can just, you can double-click the subject line, open a window, and scan through them that way, too.
Okay. All right. Well, I definitely will change that.
I'm glad that you're asking because it's really important.
The question I really had was about the broadband phone lines. I've been using Vonage since I was like a 50,000 member or something.
Wow.
So it's a long time ago, a year, 2 years ago or something. But when I do the computer versions of like the using it on the with their own adapter. Mm-hmm. It works great, but when you use it with the, they have a soft phone, they also have this V
right,
phone now,
right.
It gets really jumpy when people hear me, and I try to do all the things they say, and I've gone to the...
How fast is your computer? What kind of computer are you using?
It's a Dell, and it's it has a really high speed, it's 2 megabytes of cache.
Oh, all right.
And
because that could be one thing. When you're using a soft phone, the computer is doing the conversion that the terminal adapter would be doing. So if your computer is busy or underpowered, doesn't have enough RAM, if you're doing a lot of other things, that's when you're going to get, that's what those jumps are.
I do a lot of the things, but yeah.
So,
I don't know.
So try, you know, when you're on the phone and using one of these, the soft adapters, try shutting everything else down.
Okay. I do that. And see, when I hear your podcasts and stuff, you know, the ones with Twit
and
you do that through
Skype,
right?
Yep.
And that's really, it sounds like it's beautiful, like a normal...
Skype is better quality than anything I've used, and we've tried them all. In fact, if it weren't for Skype, I wouldn't be in the podcast business, because Skype makes it possible for me to do essentially radio-quality broadcasts with people all over the world. I mean, it's remarkable. So I highly recommend Skype. Skype has a second advantage. It's free.
Yeah, and I try that too, but it didn't sound very good on my computer. So do you use like a normal phone line? Or are you an adapter for that too?
That's interesting. So you may have other issues. So here's how we get good quality with Skype. First of all, you've got to have good upstream bandwidth. And that's true for Vonage too. It's the upstream, you know, not the download. So when you buy high-speed internet, it's they say 6 megabits a second. What they don't tell you is, what's your upstream? 128 kilobits? 250. Mm-hmm. If it's only 128 kilobits, that's right on the edge of what you need. It'd be better if you and many DSL and cable companies now will provide you with 256 or even 384. I have DSL Extreme with 384 up, so that's number one. I have a good high speed connection. Number two,
how do you find out your upstream?
Just ask your ISP. It's probably in the documents that they gave you. They have to document it. You can also go to a speed test. There are many, many, many speed tests. Go to DSLReports.com. They have a speed test there, and that'll tell you what your upstream is, your real upstream, as opposed to what the companies are telling you. You have to have either a true 128 and nothing else going on. Don't be uploading. Don't have your email running. Don't have iTunes running. Nothing else going on in the background. I mean, I shut down all programs, and then I tell the people I'm talking to, here's your job. Don't have anything else going on in the background. Don't use Wi-Fi. Use a wired internet connection.
I use Wi-Fi too.
Will give you dropouts. Yes, sir. Wi-Fi will give you dropouts. When you really want good phone connection, you want to go hardwired. I'll send them headset mics. And the best ones are USB based, like the Plantronics or the Logitech. Those have pretty good microphones. Now, on my end, I'm using a real microphone. I'm using this microphone, a studio microphone. But on the other end, all the people I'm talking to are just using Plantronics headsets. That's what we use. They're not very expensive. And then there are a few other things with Skype you can do. Everything I've told you up to now applies to Vonage as well. With Skype, you can also tell it use a dedicated port. That's in the Skype settings, and that sometimes will give you better results. If you do say use a dedicated port, you'll have to open that port forward your router to do that.
Okay. That doesn't sound, I don't understand that part.
Yeah, that's kind of more complicated. I'm not sure where we have this documented well. On the TWIT page, how we do it, about TWIT, I describe in greater detail all the Skype magic we do.
All right. Hey, I love listening to your show, so thank you very much for your great expertise, and also you make it fun to listen to.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. That's very nice of you. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, you know, I love voice over the internet. I think it's a revolution. And frankly, I'm a Vonage customer. I haven't used it in months because I like Skype so much. But Skype requires a computer. Vonage does not. Vonage, you just use your regular phone and a broadband connection. Skype, but see, I don't think that I really am anywhere in the world without a computer at all times. So I'm, you know, for me, Skype is a good solution. Skype is free from skype.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Information doesn't take the weekend off.
Neither do we.
KFI, all weekend long.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Very geekalicious. Paul in Lancaster, KFI. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Paul.
Hello. I need to be able to read RAW files, and I haven't found a reader out there. I run everything from EarthenView down through Microsoft Paint and even Photoshop, but nothing picks up a RAW file so I can read it.
Why don't we read it in the RAW? Well, the problem here, let me say what a RAW file is before I tell you what to do.
Well, it's like an MPG or whatever, but...
Actually, it's not, and that's
JPEG,
the key.
I'm sorry.
It's not. It's uncompressed. A RAW file is exactly the data that the camera on your digital camera picked up on that sensor. So, and that's why you shoot RAW. They're bigger files, but you get every bit of the information. There's no processing done in the camera. It's for people who want to use Photoshop and really work on it. Now, if you're just taking snapshots and you don't want to spend a lot of time working on the shot to make it look good, you should be taking JPEGs or TIFFs or some other form. But if you're a pro and you want this is an important shot and you want to be able to do color correction, you want to be able to tweak it, you want to control exactly how it looks, you should be shooting RAW. Of course, you're right. The problem with the RAW format, first of all, is there's no one standard. Every camera has a different format. In fact, Nikon has three or four.
Well, this is a Radio Shack credit card camera. And
Shooting RAW then. I can tell you that now.
It dumps to an SD card, and I pull it off, and I read it as a RAW file.
Is there any other?
It says it is.
It's not a RAW file. Is there any other format that camera will do? Is there a setting in there?
Nope.
That camera is designed to be brought back to Radio Shack, isn't it? Is it one of those where they're doing the processing of the image?
No.
Did it come with some software?
No, it doesn't.
I don't know what the heck you've got. The only cameras that really take RAW are high-end cameras, and now some of the more expensive point-and-shoots. But no cheesy Radio Shack cameras taking real RAW. What you're getting is some unknown format. The problem is it's not a standard. You should be getting a JPEG, maybe a TIFF. If it's a RAW, then if it really is a RAW, maybe it is. Then you've got to get the right plugins. Photoshop reads RAW, but because there's so many RAW files, they constantly update their RAW plugin. So if you're using Photoshop, EarthenView probably won't do it. A free program probably won't do it. It's a lot of work to keep up with these formats. If you're using Photoshop, though, and if you're shooting RAW, you're using Photoshop. There's no reason to shoot RAW unless you have a high-end photo editing program to process those. Because you're saying to the camera, don't process it. If you're shooting RAW, you're using Photoshop. It's very easy. Just go to Adobe.com or do a Google search for Photoshop RAW plugin. And I do this all the time. You want to get the latest. And they constantly add formats. You know, Nikon recently changed the format. They had to add a new one. I just got a Fujifilm FinePix E900. Shoot it in RAW. It's 9 megapixels. I had to download a new plugin. And in fact, iPhoto doesn't support it yet. RAW is tricky. But boy, if you're a pro, that's what you want to shoot in. Now, I think this Radio Shack is doing some weird format. If they didn't give you software, then it's going to be a Google search. I'll do it for you in a second. Radio Shack, RAW. What is this? It's probably not RAW. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio, 12:59. Time to head to the KFI News Center where Lisa Osborne has the latest.
September 23rd, 2006.
KFI is a talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks, it's 106. I'm Lisa Osborne, KFI News.
Why, that's time for me, Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. Now, I promised you Steve Gibson, and I delivered. Steve is, of course, the co-host of Security Now on the Twit podcast network at twit.tv, but he's perhaps better known as the king of security. Shields Up is perhaps the best known program on the internet for testing your firewall at grc.com. He also the creator of the great SpinRight, which is the world's best file recovery, a disk recovery and maintenance utility. Hey, Steve, welcome to KFI.
Your voice sounds really familiar to me, Leo.
I wonder why. So I have to say, I am totally disheartened, Steve. We, on Thursday, we actually had a podcast in the can and started over because of this breaking news about this major Windows security flaw. And I haven't seen coverage in the tech media, not one story. I haven't seen any mainstream coverage at all. You would think this is just business as usual.
Yeah, I think that there's so much of this happening now, and people are so continually seeing notices from their computers saying, oh, we need to install new updates and blah, blah, blah. And I also think maybe people have sort of turned responsibility over to Microsoft to just automatically keep their machines up to date, that people are tuning out. And the danger of that in this case is that Microsoft has established a monthly cycle. It's the second Tuesday of every month that Microsoft pushes these updates out. And IT, the information technology managers in corporations, really demanded this because Microsoft used to just send updates out with no particular schedule whenever they got around to it, which really caused a problem for in corporate environments because the information technology managers didn't know when to expect something. And many times, these changes Microsoft is continually making to fix problems and in some cases add features, they can have an impact on the operation of machines within a corporation.
Yeah, but meanwhile we're stuck waiting a month with our pants down. I mean, this is
exactly.
This is an extremely serious flaw that affects every single person, no matter how patched your Windows is. If you're using Windows XP and Internet Explorer, you're vulnerable.
Well, and we know that tens of thousands of visitors to websites which are now using this latest vulnerability, which was discovered in the wild, are being infected with as many as 50 different forms of keystroke loggers, malware, spyware, adware, you know, all this junk.
People are going to think that we're being sensationalistic here, and I really want to say this is not sensationalistic. This is a real threat that is in the wild. It's out there right now. It affects everybody who uses Internet Explorer and Windows XP. There are a couple of fixes which we'll get to in a little bit, but just so people understand how widespread this is, would you explain this web attack kit that people are that's being used?
Yes. What's happened is there's been, over the years, there's been an evolution in the availability of malicious usage tools. There are websites where, for example, people who aren't experts in computers, aren't really skilled hackers, are simply able to go to a website and download a kit of assault tools, essentially, that enable them to do things to other people's computers online that they themselves don't have the skills to do. Well, this web attack kit is being offered to webmasters, that is, people who control and manage websites. And these are not mainstream, you know, Google, MSNBC, Amazon.com, you know, or KFI's website, for example. These are sort of the seamy side of the net, sites that specialize in pornography, in offering illegitimate software downloads. You know, I mean, sort of the places you wouldn't want normally to be going on the net, but
hundreds of thousands of people keep these places going by visiting them, by looking at the advertising and so forth.
Well, Eric Stiles, who works for the company that discovered this whole problem, Sunbelt Software, told us that one of the most popular places to put these things is on these cracks sites, where people go to get serial numbers or software cracks so that they can remove copy protection from programs. That's apparently a very popular place to put this stuff.
Yes, and in fact, I confess I've visited those places too. Because, you know, for example, sometimes you'll find something that is locked. The company is gone. Their website is gone. You want to use this.
You bought something and now you can't use it because of for reasons like that. I mean, there are legitimate reasons. However, I'm not going to those sites anymore.
No.
Jeez.
No. Or if you do, you need to take some kind of, serious precaution to prevent your systems from being compromised. Now, the reason I wanted to come on the show today, Leo, is that this is a real problem, but we're not just saying, oh my God, the sky is falling. We have a solution, and if there weren't a solution,
we'd still say the sky was falling.
don't use your computer until the middle of October.
I think we'd have to say something even if there weren't a solution. Fortunately, the solution is pretty easy.
Yes.
So what do you do?
Yes. So essentially, what happened is this is an exploit that is made available because there was another mistake found in Windows dating back to Internet Explorer 5. So this has been around for quite a while, and the problem is that whereas normally these problems are found by good guys, they're found by security researchers who are pounding on Windows or Unix or the Mac or whatever computer that is their current target. They'll find a problem and they'll think, "Oh, whoopsie!" Contact the publisher, and this it might be Microsoft or Apple, or it could be the publisher of just a regular application where there's a vulnerability that's been found. So the security researcher will contact the publisher, notify them confidentially that a problem's been found, and wait for them to fix it. Once it's been fixed, then in the case of Microsoft, for example, Microsoft will acknowledge that the problem was found by a certain researcher group and give them credit for it and produce the patch. Well, what we've been seeing is that if people don't apply these patches quickly, the actual patch itself can be reverse engineered, bad guys can find out what the problem was that Microsoft has fixed.
They call that a zero-day exploit.
The zero-day exploit is what we have in this case, which is a very different scenario, where the first awareness of this problem is when it is discovered
it's already
being
there.
Used
right.
on the net. So what we've been seeing over the years is there's been an evolution in patches are quickly reverse engineered and exploits are applied to these vulnerabilities. But what's even worse is where a bad guy, not a good guy security researcher, but a real malicious hacker, discovers a vulnerability and starts using it. Now, there are vulnerabilities for sale on the net. There are, in fact, auction sites, little known off the mainstream auction sites, and deals going on where vulnerabilities are being sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these are unknown, unpatched vulnerabilities.
Wow.
that then people who have a strong economic interest in abusing people's machines remotely will use these to install their adware, their keystroke loggers, or whatever. In this case, this vulnerability was discovered on the net by good guys, but after it had already escaped and was being used in the wild to install this malicious software. What Eric's group at Sunbelt Software did was they, from time to time, they deliberately go out onto the net into these dark corners, where there are crack site software, pornography sites, fake free file downloads is another come on that is often used to lure unsuspecting people to a site. And what happens is they suddenly realized, wait a minute, there's junk popping up and installing in our machines, which are fully patched, have the very latest patches.
So we're almost out of time, Steve. So I've got to get to the point, which is how do you fix this darn thing?
It is possible to unregister the program. If you'll go to my site, grc.com, the top of my homepage at grc.com has a link to our podcast and to a page with very clear instructions that anyone can follow to protect themselves, which they should do, anyone using Windows, until the October updates.
Well, we don't even know if Microsoft will patch it then. I mean, we were hoping Microsoft will patch it then, but unregistering that DLL is probably the best thing to do right now.
Yep.
And furthermore, there may be, and this is a purely anecdotal, issues associated with unregistering it. Somebody told me that Peachtree stops working, so you might want to pay attention. You could also just not use Internet Explorer, right?
Yes, avoiding Internet Explorer would function, although email is another entry. We expect to see a lot of use and abuse
right.
of this because it is not patched by Microsoft.
We talked about this earlier, just turning off that preview pay in Outlook, or not better yet, not using Outlook, using Thunderbird or some program that doesn't use IE to render images in the email.
Right.
Because that's the vulnerability.
Right.
It's scary, but it just baffles me that there is zero coverage about this. I think you and I are the only people talking about it at all, and I guess people are just battle-hardened.
Well, I do know from looking at the downloads of our page from Thursday's podcast, where we talk about this and then give people some solutions, that many tens of thousands of people are taking this seriously, and
yeah.
the word is spreading,
good.
Even though we're the people spreading the word.
Well, that's why you're on the show and on the podcast,
right.
twit.tv/SN or grc.com for more information about this particular vulnerability. And, of course, the Security Now podcast is weekly and well worth listening to. Steve's just a great resource to the security community. His other programs like Shields Up, Unplug and Pray, The Decombobulator, and more are at gsc.com. And his bread and butter is SpinRite, the world's best disk recovery and maintenance utility, a must-have. If you have a hard drive, you really need SpinRite. grc.com. Steve,
well,
really
Leo, and I know that people are listening because our website just went wild.
You see? People do listen
yep.
to this show. You didn't believe me.
Yep. It's a great thing.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Leo.
Take care. We'll talk again next Thursday on Security Now. And of course, anytime there's a major security issue like this, you can count on hearing it about it on this show. I'm not going to assume that you're gun shy, that you're battle hardened. I'm going to assume you need this information. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 119.
They never back down. John and Ken, Monday 3 to 7.
KFI, AM 640.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Let's go to Missouri. Say hi to Keith. Hello, Keith. Welcome to KFI.
Hi. Quick question. How do I get more people to view my blog? I spoke with you a couple of
I remember.
Yeah. And also, another quick question. When I do move to TypePad, will I be able to move my content from Blogger to...
I think they have an import tool. Yes, I do believe they do.
Okay.
But you should ask them. But that's pretty common, and Blogger is such a common format that
okay.
I'm pretty sure you'll be able to do that. I know I've certainly moved around from blog to blog and always taken
okay.
my content with me. Publicizing a blog is, it's kind of the same as publicizing a web page. There's no magic formula. It's marketing.
Right.
It's getting the word out there. I mean,
right.
When we talked about this before, the better, good content, fresh content, that's one of the things about a blog that's key, and one of the reasons blogs are popular is you update it regularly. It's not like some
right.
static web page that doesn't ever change.
Right.
All of that's important. All of that will help. And then, you know, I think really, you know, getting to your audience in other ways, in other, all, you know, other media is a great way to do it, either through other websites or message boards. You know, one of the ways that there's a wonderful podcast called Skepticality that is all about debunking pseudoscience and stuff like that. And one of the ways they were able to really take off is by going to message boards where scientists hang out and saying, you know, I mean, you got to kind of think out of the box. You got to reach your audience and find a way to get them to not only to read your blog, but to link to it. Because, of course, the more people who link to it, the more people who pick up your entries. And sometimes, you know, people do, and I think this is maybe not advisable, but I have to say people do it. Sometimes people will make intentionally sensationalistic entries that they know will be picked up by sites like Dig or Slashdot. And, you know, if you get Dug or Slashdotted, you're going to drive a lot of traffic. People are going to come see your site, and one hopes that some of them will stick, will come back.
Okay, well, I just wanted to just thank you again, because, I mean, because with you and with Amber, as a matter of fact, on my blog with audio, it gives you the opportunity, I guess, where to even listen to
That's neat.
The podcast and what I've
That's great. What's the address of your blog?
It is theologyintechnology.blogspot.com.
I have, you know, it's funny. I started typing my browser in my browser, and it had it in there because I've been there before. It's a great site, and you're doing you're doing a great job, Keith. Just people should go there, and you know, of course, calling and talking about it on the radio show doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, this is true too.
That's a good way to plug it.
Thank you, and also too, I hope that other project gets off the ground. Undo TV.
Yeah, that's what we're
from what I because I mentioned that in one of my entries in my blog as well.
Oh, thank
and if
you.
That does. I mean, that is so good, and it's,
we're excited.
It's
about
just
it.
Really a blessing just to have all you guys out there again, because I was really upset when Tech TV was taken off the air, because to me nowadays it just seemed like, I think I heard John C. Dvorak say it too, so many with the content out there now, it's like they're really trying to dummy down.
I agree.
Toward the audience, but it's really been a blessing for all you guys, because now all
thank
you
goodness
all are
for
doing
podcasting.
Your own thing,
and I agree.
And right, exactly. So
hey, I
so
gotta run. I gotta run. I thank you. News is coming up, and but Keith, I really thank you for the kind words, and let me tell them again: theologyintechnology.blogspot.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 1:30. Lisa Osborne is in the KFI News Center.
It's for your own good. Dr. Laura, Monday, noon to 3.
KFI, AM 640.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Dr. Dean coming up in about 20 minutes, and then it's a fresh John and Ken this afternoon from 3 to 5. But meanwhile, let's get back to the phones at 1-800-520-1KFI, starting with Tom in L.A. Hello, Tom. Welcome.
Yes, sir. Hi, Leo.
Hey.
I got a large item I want to sell, a toolbox with a lot of tools.
Oh.
What's the best way to advertise it without having my own website? Or is that?
Oh, there are lots of ways to do it. There's Craigslist. There's eBay. In fact, eBay might be a really good way to do it.
EBay.
Yeah, eBay is, of course, the online auction site. In fact,
I can post my pictures.
You sure can. And and you can. Now, eBay's a little more complicated. You have to kind of sign up for an account, and there are lots of online guides. In fact, eBay even has them. If you think you're going to be doing more of this, it's really worth learning how to use eBay. I think you'll get the best dollar for it, because it's an auction. So, and you can set a reserve. You can say, well, I'm not going to sell it for less than this. But because it's an auction, prices tend to be accurately reflect the value of the product, right? Because you've got people from all over the country bidding on it. Now, if it's heavy, as yours is, you'll have to, you want to make sure you say, and the shipping's going to cost such and such, so that people know ahead of time. And almost always on eBay, the buyer pays the shipping. not you. And you know, you'll ship it a inexpensive way, slow boat to China, kind of, but because it's so heavy. But I think that's a good way to do it. The other way, of course, is online classified ads, and there's Craigslist and a number of other places like that that are great ways to sell products. But then you set the price. They're more like classified ads where you set the price, and you know, you'll have people calling and maybe even coming over and looking at them and that kind of thing. But I think eBay is in some ways the best way to do it. We'll put links in the show notes to some how-to articles on eBay. They have very good instructional stuff that'll tell you how to do it. Okay?
Good. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, good luck. Actually, I might buy them myself. I'm a sucker for tools. I never use them, but I love them. I buy them. Jay, Simi Valley, welcome. KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey,
here's
Jay.
The situation.
Okay.
I'm in a business park, and I share DSL with my neighbor. Now, the DSL that we have is really slow. It's about 188K, I just measured.
Okay.
And they tell us that we're almost too far from the main
office. That's why. Yep.
Yeah. Now, another neighbor that, you know, we used to share with, he uses wireless broadband, and he loves it, and now he's 100% that.
Yeah.
Now, we'd love to switch, but, you know, we're in an office. We need to share it. Is there a way where we could set up a computer to act as like a router to share the wireless broadband service?
Yeah, there are two ways to do it. One is to have one computer have the wireless broadband card in it. These are the services, you're probably looking at Verizon's, but other companies are now doing this, and it's about $60 a month. And you get very high speed, much higher speed than you're getting. You know, in some cases, as much as a megabit, depending on where you are. I would try before you get too excited about it. If you can get somebody to come over with a laptop with a wireless card in it or something like that, just to see how it is at your location.
Right.
Because it's not consistent by any means. It has a lot to do with where you are, how far you are from the cell site, and most importantly, how many other people are using that cell site.
Okay.
So it's very much impacted by those things.
Okay.
But it can be very, 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 very fast. Considering it's coming over essentially cellular technology.
Right.
You can have it, if it's in a computer, using Windows Internet Connection Sharing, you can share it. One way to do it, maybe you have a laptop that has a Wi-Fi card, and then you plug in the broadband card, and you can use it, the Wi-Fi, what's called ad hoc Wi-Fi, to actually share it wirelessly. There's also, and we found this out after the show a few weeks ago, where somebody asked me, is there some way to take one of these cards and put it in a router? There are. They're not cheap, but there are Wi-Fi routers that support these broadband cards. You put the card in, and it turns it into a wireless router.
Mm.
So that's kind of a neat way to do it when you don't have to have string wires. Is your partner in the same office as nearby, and you can have wires going from one to the other?
Yeah, that's how we do it.
We
just run wires through the wall.
Easiest way to do it, just put it in your desktop. And you'll have to have, as you already do, probably an Ethernet card in the desktop. And that gives you essentially two Ethernet or two network devices. One, and that's what Internet connection sharing needs. One that the Internet's coming in on and one that the sharing is going out on.
Great.
ICS. Okay. It's built into Windows. It's actually pretty easy.
Okay. Another quick question?
Sure.
Okay. Firefox, I love it, but there's one thing I haven't figured out. I can't make it get it to make the navigation click, which I'm used to with IE. Is there a way?
You want it to go every time you click?
Exactly. You got it.
Oh, I'm sure there's got to be a way to do that.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That. Yeah.
I never thought of that, but you're right. IE does that little click, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, the good news about Firefox is that the way it's designed, it's very easy to extend its user interface. And that's why there are hundreds of extensions for Firefox. I'm just looking through. I just typed, if you in Firefox, you go to Tools, the Tools menu, and you select Extensions. That'll show you the extensions you've installed, but then there's also a button at the bottom called Get More Extensions.
Okay.
And that'll take you to the Firefox site that has all the extensions. And I mean, there are literally hundreds and hundreds. And I bet you, I just did a search for click and I don't see anything, but you might have to be more clever in how you're searching. I bet you somebody has. I mean, it's not a hard thing to do.
Right.
It's a very easy thing to do. And if nobody's done it, it's only because nobody wants it.
Right.
You may be the only one. If that's the case, Jay, you might have to write it yourself. I'll tell you what, if anybody knows, they should put it on the show notes or call us or mention it in the chat room. We'll find somebody.
Okay, I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, we'll find a way to let you know.
Great. Thanks, Leo.
I actually, you know, it's funny, Jay. I think you're right. I forgot about it. I haven't used an Internet Explorer in so long. I forgot it clicked.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Right.
Actually, they say in the chat room there is a sound extension for Firefox. So let me do a little search. Sound extension. See if they're... navigational sounds. There you go.
All right.
The IE click. It's navigational sounds 103. I can't use it on Mac, but they have it on Windows because that's a Windows thing. That would make sense. So, yes. The answer is yes. And thanks to Toilet Bug. That's his name in our chat room. I'm sorry, but that is his name, and he's the one who found it first. Thank you, Jay. Take care.
Thanks, Leo.
That's talking about instant response. it's Mozilla add-on 1030. Navigational sounds, a simple extension that plays the Windows OS start and end navigational sounds when pages start and finish loading. That is the click from IE. And I'd forgotten, but I kind of like that sound. Somebody's comment, actually it's the developer's comments. If you don't like the click sound IE plays when clicking a link, don't get this extension. Okay. And you can customize it from the Windows Sound Scheme control panel. So it's simple to change. And you know, it could say something else. It could say, ow, stop poking me. Or, you know, something like that. David Pasadena, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, David.
Hi. For almost 20 years, I've had a PC at home, and I'm thinking of going with a Mac. I want to know the downside.
Shocking.
My concern is that work uses PC, and I every now and then need to bring home Word, Excel, PowerPoint home, you know, and I'll bring it home on like a USB flash and do work at home, and I don't want to have... conflicting problem.
No problem, because the good news is Microsoft Office on Windows and Mac are compatible 100%. In fact, they're very much the same programs. So you'll bring them home on a flash drive. You'll open them. Nobody will even know. Your secret will be safe. They'll never know.
What are some downsides to going with the Mac then?
Well, of course there's downsides. The biggest will be it's a different operating system. So all your programs won't work. You'll have to get all new software, including a new...
Pardon?
Go ahead.
I typically use Quicken, Netscape, and like an Adobe Light for my digital camera.
Yep. You'll have to... Netscape's free, but you'll have to buy a new Quicken and an Adobe, yeah.
Right.
See, it doesn't use the same software. Well, the other disadvantage, this is less tangible. I mean, there's a real disadvantage in buying new software. I think that might be the number one reason people don't switch, is because you got to buy new software. Secondarily, it's a new operating system. It behaves differently. And I've talked about this before. You know, the buttons are not where you expect. There's no start menu. So there will be a period of discomfort, maybe a few weeks, could even be a few months, I guess, where you just don't feel at home. You're in a strange town. But it doesn't take too long to get used to it. I would go out and get a three-button mouse, a Windows, or keep your Windows mouse. They work fine with Macs, and you'll still have the scroll wheel and the left and right button. Apple doesn't believe in them, but they work fine. That, you know, the software supports it. You may find there are things you like better. But it's different. Not better, not worse, different. Reasons to go with a Mac. It is, I think, more stable. It's a newer operating system. It's certainly more secure. There's no virus or spyware issue at all. That by itself is enough reason. You know, I just read an article in InfoWorld. I was surprised. This is a pretty heavy-duty enterprise, business-focused, Windows-focused magazine, in which they said it's time for businesses to start looking at Macs, not just home. For a long time, I said Windows in business, Macintosh at home. But now even businesses are saying we can't deal with this virus and spyware issue. We can't deal with these reliability issues. We need something that gets the job done. And frankly, if you're not using specialized applications that are Windows only, if you're using things like Microsoft Office, the net, email, all of that's the same. You know, it's just a different operating system, but the applications work exactly the same. Leo Laporte, except for maybe that little click when you click a link, things like that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. It's 149.
KFI News.
Fox News.
Together, bringing you the big stories.
KFI AM 640.
157 KFI AM 640. More stimulating. Stimulating talk radio. Lester in Menifee, California. Hello, Lester. Welcome to KFI.
Our last Leo?
Call of the day. You just made it in.
Hello, Leo.
Hey, Lester.
Yes. I'm 85, and I'm trying to catch up on TV and Dish and DSL and that kind of stuff.
Well, good for you. That's great.
I want to get a new TV, and I wonder what you say about plasma plus versus LED.
You know, it's LCD. Plasmas, I think, are the brightest, best-looking displays. However, they don't wear very well, and they're fairly expensive. How big a display are you looking for, Lester?
I'm looking for something around 42 inches wide.
So you have a choice, because the LCDs, after about 47 inches, you can't get them any bigger. I like LCD. I mean, I'll tell you, I'll put my money where my mouth is. I bought an LCD. It's more expensive per square inch than plasma. But I just like how they look. I think they're better in a daylit room, for instance. So viewing conditions are relevant. The other choice that I think you shouldn't ignore is DLP rear projection. DLP gives you a very good-looking picture for a lot less money. The rear projections, you can get much larger sizes for a tenth as much. Well, maybe not that little, but a quarter as much as you spend for plasma or LCD. And I think they look very good. So don't ignore DLP rear projections.
Okay,
but otherwise, it's kind of a push. You should just go and look and see what you like better. If you really want thin screen, your choice is going to be LCD or plasma. The DLP is a little bit thicker.
Okay, well, I really don't need anything.
42 inches isn't that big. I would look at the 42-inch Sharp Aquos, and then I would look at there's a company named Vizio that makes a relatively inexpensive. I think it's a 50-inch plasma. I think it's only a couple of grand, and that's a pretty nice-looking screen.
And what's the name of that one?
I think it's Vizio, and I should remember it. It begins with a V. They're selling it at Costco, I think, the warehouse stores.
Yeah, I've seen that. Okay.
And I think those are very reasonable, and I think look pretty darn good. So I think that's a good choice, to be honest with you. I think you'd be happiest with the plasma. It's going to cost you a little bit less. It's going to give you a better-looking display. I think that's a good choice. Enjoy, though. I'm jealous. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm also out of time. I got to run, but I'll be back tomorrow, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and we'll be talking about high tech. You can hear more of me all week long on twit.tv. That's my podcast network. It's really turning into a little mini radio station. We've got so many shows now. Our new Vista show launches as soon as I can get it out the door with Paul Thurrott. It's a countdown to the new Windows Vista. I'll see you tomorrow, okay, on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Dina Dell's next, but right now at 1:59, it's Lisa Osborne in the KFI News Center. Well, that's it for this edition of The Tech Guy on KFI. Thanks so much for listening. If you're ever in the Southern California area, I hope you'll listen live on the radio every Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on KFI AM 640. You can also listen on the internet anytime at KFIAM640.com. Archives of older shows are available online on my website. That's leo.am. Click the audio archives button. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, which is leo.am/podcasts/KFI. My thanks to Howard Bailey for providing the theme music for this show. You can listen to Howard's music at soundclick.com. Thanks to DSL Extreme for providing the bandwidth. Of course, first of all, thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time on KFI.